Okay, so actually several of the speakers today, Matthew and Jaco and John Kirk, have covered a lot of the background material, a lot of the material I'm going to talk about, so I can actually probably get through the 150 slides I have in my time. Just go much faster than I expected. So I'm going to talk about cosmic ray production and supernova remnants, of course. And first, a couple words on the origin of galactic cosmic rays. We've heard about this before. The main problems is the source of the energy, source of the material, and how you accelerate the bulk of the cosmic rays. And there's two problems here, the acceleration of those below the knee, which are certainly galactic, and the origin of the highest energy cosmic rays. Here I'm just going to restrict the discussion to those below the knee. I'm not going to worry about the highest energies. And if you do that, then the source of the energy is pretty clear, supernovae. The source of material is also reasonably clear. It's gas and dust from the well-mixed interstellar medium. The acceleration, of course, is still a problem that we're concerned about here. But most likely, it's diffusive shock acceleration in the outer blast wave of supernova remnants. But even if that's the case, then there's still some problems. You need to be efficient. You may need 10% or more efficiency of conversion of the energy in the supernova remnant shocks. So is 10% efficiency possible? This mechanism, diffusive shock acceleration, certainly theoretically can easily do this. It can put 50, 75, 99% of the energy into relativistic particles. But we don't know if real shocks can do that. But if you are efficient, then you must consider nonlinear effects. They must be taken into account. So most everything I say in this talk is going to be concerned with nonlinear effects in shock acceleration. As far as the composition, this same mechanism, nonlinear shock acceleration of the ISM gas and dust, provides a nice quantitative explanation for cosmic ray composition. Okay, the acceleration of cosmic rays. What are the main theory issues? First of all, this whole thing about the magnetic field amplification, and this impacts the maximum energy that you can get. This is a long-standing problem for cosmic rays. Can you get up to the knee and above in isolated supernova remnants? The spectral shape, of course, you actually want to match what is observed. That has not yet been done in detail. Again, the question of efficiency and nonlinear effects, are these in fact important? If they are, what do they tell us? Important question, electrons. We see almost primarily electrons in the radio and the synchrotron, but shocks almost certainly put much more energy into ions, so this is a very, very important question, the electron-to-proton ratio. This is why seeing a pi and decay feature is so important. These, of course, are the same issues facing relativistic shocks and gamma ray bursts. Can internal or external shocks accelerate electrons with high efficiency? Is the electron spectrum consistent with gamma ray emission? What fraction of the energy goes into protons versus electrons? Is the magnetic field amplified by large factors? The difference is that we actually have some hope of answering these questions with studying supernova remnants. Okay, so how do we go about doing this? Well, we have to deal with the observations. We can look at cosmic rays observed at the Earth, photons from the diffuse galactic emission, but I'm going to only consider here photons from particular supernova remnants. And here I think detailed models of individual supernova remnants where you have nonlinear shock acceleration coupled to the remnant hydrodynamics may offer the best way to address these theory issues. So what we're going to do is have models, and I'm not the only one that have done this, of course. Many people have. Jaco talked about this. Non-thermal broadband continuum emission models fitted to supernova remnant observations. And also, another thing that is maybe just as important is the impact of the acceleration of relativistic particles on the thermal X-ray observations. Nonlinear shock acceleration modifies the evolution and the shock heating, so it modifies the thermal plasma producing X-rays in supernova remnants. Here's a wonderful image of Tycho. This is from Warren et al. I'm going to use this as a test case to a large degree here. Other young remnants show similar features. In addition to this broadband large-scale morphology, we also have broadband continuum emission from radio X-rays to TEVs. In this case, we only have upper limits from Hegra. You also have constraints on the forward shock X-ray precursor. Talk a little bit about this, and then the question of the thermal X-rays. So this is the model that I've developed with Anne DeCrochelle and Jean Boulet. Very simple 1D cosmic ray where I've coupled the cosmic ray acceleration to the hydro, the supernova remnant. So it's spherically symmetric. you have the reverse shock, contact discontinuity, and forward shock. This is the shocked ejecta. This is the shocked ISM. So this is the model that I have. This is a standard hydro model that's been around for years. What I've done is I've put in nonlinear shock acceleration into this. This is what you would get without shock acceleration. This is the temperature, the density, the pressure, and so on. This is it's a function of radius in this radiosymmetric model. Now, the point is that these quantities, the temperature and the density and so on, will be modified when we include shock acceleration. Okay, now, brief description of the theory of shock acceleration in non-relativistic shocks. Okay. The test particle power law. This is the famous mechanism that now is almost 30 years old. In test particle diffusive shock acceleration, you end up with a power law in momentum where the index depends only on the compression ratio. And in addition, for a test particle case, for strong shocks, the compression ratio is 4. So you have virtually a parameter-independent power law, P to the minus 4 or E to the minus 2. This comes about because particles scatter back and forth across this discontinuous shock. So this is the power law right here. Now, this test particle power law only gives you the power law spectrum. It does not give you the normalization. It's only a test particle result. So whatever thermal particles may be there is completely not described by the model. And here's this so-called quasi-universal power law. In all these plots, I'm plotting P to the fourth times the distribution function. So P to the minus 4 is a flat line on this curve. OK, that's test particle. But if the acceleration is efficient, this is not adequate. What happens if the acceleration is efficient? Well, now the cosmic rays must influence the shock structure. If they have enough energy, they're going to influence the shock structure. Instead of the discontinuous shock, the shock would be smooth as particles scatter back and forth. This does several things. It produces this concave spectrum that Jaco was speaking about. And this is very, very robust prediction. Only assumption is that the diffusion coefficient is an increasing function of momentum, which almost certainly has to be the case. It increases the compression. It allows the compression ratio to increase above 4. In fact, there's no limit. In principle, it could become 100 or 1,000, just like a radiative shock, only instead of radiating photons, we're radiating cosmic rays. They leave the system. Next thing is that the energy that goes into cosmic rays comes out of the thermal gas, so the temperature drops. And this is a log scale. This can be a large effect, factor of 10 easily. The other thing is that you get this non-thermal tail on the electron and proton distributions coming off the thermal. In the test particle, of course, the test particle power law is independent of the thermal distribution. Here it is not. You lose your universal power law. You now have this concave spectrum. And the other thing, of course, is that now the entire spectrum must be described self-consistently. And this is what makes this very powerful, because it connects the photon emission across the entire spectrum from radio to gamma rays. The two effects, the concave spectrum and the increase in the compression ratio above 4, are very robust predictions of this model.
What does the compression ratio depend on?
It depends on the efficiency. It depends basically on the fraction of energy that you put into the cosmic rays. And in this case here, it's well over 50%. Okay. So basically, it depends on the Mach number of the shock. The higher the Mach number, the more efficient, and the larger the compression ratio. This is a fit to Tycho. This is by Folk et al. And they're fitting the radio and the X-ray. This is their spectrum. Their model is basically very similar to one I just described. It has these nonlinear effects in it. It has the hydrodynamics in it. Note the curvature. It's not much, but it is significant and is important to fit the observations, as Jaco said. So this is Tycho. Broadband emission, continuum emission. They also have Hegra upper limits on this, and they have fit this with pi and decay in this model. So now we have this broadband emission. And how do we fit it? Well, the shock acceleration accelerates protons and electrons. By all accounts, far more energy is going to go into the protons, but protons do not radiate very efficiently, so it's very hard to see them. We see the electrons, unless we can see pi and decay. Of course, these spectra here involve several free parameters, which I'm not going to describe right now. But what do these spectra produce? The thermal portions produce the thermal X-rays. GEV electrons produce radio. The highest energy TeV electrons produce non-thermal X-ray synchrotron. These same electrons produce inverse Compton. The only part of these spectra that produce visible emission is the highest energy protons, which produce pi and decay. All the other emission comes from the electrons. So we have four processes: synchrotron, inverse Compton, pi and decay, and Bremsstrahlung, coming from these two particle spectra. These are just the continuum emission. And we have a wide range of coverage with instruments. Glass is going to be very important here, but these spectra are relatively well covered, certainly will be with GLAST. In addition to the continuum emission, we do have the emission lines from the thermal X-rays, and this, I think, will contain a lot of information and allow us to, hopefully, to constrain these models. The models have a lot of parameters. Even though they have broadband observations, you still have to figure out a way to constrain the parameters in the models. Here, this is a very, very important point. Is the TeV emission coming from pi and decay or inverse Compton? In this particular model, the inverse Compton is very high, but that's just because I happen to have chosen parameters that produce this. The relative normalization of these two processes depends very strongly on the parameters that you choose, on the ambient conditions. It's only really the shape that can distinguish between them if you just look in that TeV range. Broadband models, in principle, can discriminate, because then if you modify the emission here, the relative emission of these two processes, you modify the emission across the entire range. These are cartoon. Okay? Yeah, this is an actual model here. Okay? That was just a cartoon. So here's the Tycho, the observations, the radio, X-ray. Here's the Hager upper limit. And I'm just using this. Of course, Hess has these wonderful spectra for other remnants. So here are the observations. Now here's a model that's actually where I've chosen to fit the observations. Here's radio, X-ray, and this is, in fact, pi and decay is matching the upper limit on Hegra. Okay, this is coming from that model I described. So now this part, these fits actually are very similar to the model I showed from Volk and Breschko et al. And in fact, as I said before, our models are very, very similar. The physics is very similar. The parameters are almost the same. Physics is pretty much the same. The main point here is to get this fit is that you need a large shocked magnetic field to fit the broadband continuum observations. And we both come up with values of above 200 microgauss. The problem here is that in both of our models, we have not included magnetic field amplification, the Bell-Lucek. They're not in these models, not yet. What we have, both of these models, is just shock compression. So we have compression ratios which are relatively small, about 5. B2 is compressed. So in order to get this high of a shocked field, you have to start with a very high ISM field. That's an important point. Okay. And again, for this particular set, the pi and decay is dominating. So is this direct evidence that cosmic ray ions are being produced? Well, I'm not so sure yet. Because let's look at this. Here's the model I just showed you. This is crazy up here, it seems to me, that you have to start off with a ISM field of 60 microgauss. Both their model and my model has to do this if you just compress the field. Well, can I fit these observations with a lower field? Here I'm taking 15 instead of 60. I end up with 70 instead of 250. If you just look at the X-rays and the TeV, I get an excellent fit. As over here. The radio is way off here. And you can say, ah, this is telling us that this is the model. But you have to remember, these radio observations were taken, I don't know how, 30 years ago. I'm not at all convinced that the normalization of these radio observations is exactly the same as the X-rays. I think there's some room for doubt there. What we really need are consistent radio and X-ray observations of exactly the same region in a supernova remnant to make this comparison. In this model, inverse Compton dominates in TeV range. So changing these parameters by not a whole lot changes this ratio considerably. Okay. Both of those models, the 15 microgauss, the 60 microgauss, can in fact produce cosmic rays up to the knee. Here are the two models. This is the proton spectrum. But remember, above the knee, we really only have to produce fully ionized iron to match the observations. because you can see the abundance of cosmic rays getting heavier as you go through the neat. So you multiply these by a factor of 26, and they both do a reasonably good job. So we're getting up there. We're getting up there. So we're getting up there with the maximum energy. The overall efficiency in these models is extremely high. This is a previous paper, but it's exactly the same thing, basically. You easily can put 50% of the explosion energy, the energy that went into the ejecta kinetic energy of the supernova remnant, into cosmic rays over the lifetime of the cosmic ray. This is Bresko's result. This is our result. This was shown years ago by Dorfi and other people. And of course, Bresko made this point very clearly a few years ago. Because it's so efficient, you have an abundance of riches here. You really only have to accelerate cosmic rays only 25% or so of the surface area to power cosmic rays. Okay. Now, here are those the pine decay and the inverse Compton spectra from that previous model that I showed. Of course, the model was for Tycho. I just took some of the Hess observations for RxJ 1713 just as an illustration. This is their beautiful power law, but if you map it onto this spectrum, which covers such a large dynamic range, you see that it's pretty hard, actually, to distinguish between inverse Compton and pine decay purely by the shape in these models, I think. So, are supernova, young supernova remnants accelerating ions efficiently? I think there's still a question mark. What is the electron-to-proton ratio of accelerated particles? Very important, critical question for gamma-ray bursts, certainly for the afterglow. Is the magnetic field amplified by large factors? I think we still don't know, but there's another thing that we can look at, and that is indirect evidence may come from the morphology of supernova remnants. Okay. First of all, in these shock models, I said you can get very high compression ratios. It depends on the parameters. If you start off with a low magnetic field, ISM magnetic field, 3 microgauss, 5 microgauss, it turns out that the shock acceleration process turns out to be more efficient and ends up with a larger compression ratio. You can easily get compression ratios above 10, above 20 early on. Simultaneously, you get a shock temperature which is much less than the test particle value, a factor of 10 or so. So keep in mind that we can get these large compression ratios. Increase in the compression ratio and a decrease in shock temperature with efficient cosmic ray acceleration. These are large effects when the initial magnetic field is low, and I'll explain why that's the case in a minute. So, compression ratios much greater than 4 should surely show up in the morphology. And sure enough, they do. Okay, here now, you put in cosmic ray acceleration in these hydro models. This is what I got before. This is the ratio of the radius of the contact discontinuity or the forward shock. Here's the profile. Without cosmic ray acceleration, this is about 0.85. That's hard to vary in these hydro models if you don't have cosmic ray acceleration. With cosmic ray acceleration, this region is much denser. Therefore, it's going to be spatially smaller. And you can get ratios above 0.95. This is a simulation that John Blondin did actually a couple years ago where we put in cosmic ray acceleration kind of by hand. This is the case with no acceleration. You see the forward shock well separated from the contact discontinuity. As you increase the acceleration efficiency, this region becomes spatially narrow. And eventually, with very efficient acceleration, the contact discontinuity can actually disrupt the forward shock. Okay. Signature of efficient diffusive shock acceleration. Again, the interaction region becomes narrower and denser. Simultaneously, the proton temperature becomes less in this region than expected for test particle models. Okay, now, as Tycho and other people have shown, using the spectra, the X-ray spectra alone, you can really identify the forward shock and the contact discontinuity in these remnants. Here's his Kepler. This ratio right here is what I'm going to be looking at now. The fact that this is very close to 1, that the contact discontinuity is almost up against the forward shock. And again, in hydro models without cosmic ray acceleration, this is very hard to come up with a ratio this close to 1. Okay. Now here are these observations from Warren et al. Again of Tycho supernova remnant. What they did is they identified the outer forward shock. The green line here is the contact discontinuity, as you can see going around there. and the contact discontinuity lies close to the outer blast wave. And I thought it was really quite striking that you see these regions where it's actually impinging on the forward shock. And this looks at least superficially similar to what was in our simulation in 2001. Okay. You can ask Jack or Jessica that. It's by this, I think, the spectral line composition, but they're the experts on that. Okay, here, this is also their plot, where they actually get a quantitative measure. So here's this ratio is greater than 0.95. This is the observed. When they make an adjustment for the distortions in the contact discontinuity, this goes down, but it's still about 0.93. So this is their result for the average separation. So, can you get this with these shock acceleration models? Yes, you can, very, very nicely. This is Tycho's supernova remnant. This is the model that we did. This actually is in preparation. Here's the contact discontinuity. Here's the reverse shock. This is the forward shock. Here's the Tycho data. You can match that really nicely, but you have to have compression ratios greater than 10 to do this. First of all, you cannot do it at all with test particle acceleration. You forget about that. But to match this, you really need to have compression ratios greater than 10. 6, remember, 6 was the compression ratio of the broadband models that had the high magnetic fields. Both mine and Breschko's came up with the compression ratio. 6 will not fit the morphology. So I think that's an interesting dilemma. The dilemma is that the morphology, which is a very clear observation, it seems to me, requires a large compression ratio, which requires a small magnetic field, ISM magnetic field, before it's shocked. Broadband fits required a large B shocked, but if you only have compression of the magnetic field, then you have to start with a large ISM field to get that. Now, the reason that this is the case is that in both our models, the assumption is that the cosmic rays produce alpha wave turbulence in the shock precursor. The turbulence saturates, this is what we assume, and heats the cold incoming plasma, transferring energy from the cosmic rays to the heat. This heating weakens the subshock and damps the acceleration rate. So the larger the field in the precursor, the more heating you have, the weaker the subshock and the weaker the acceleration. So it's paradoxical. The higher the field you have, the weaker the acceleration is, the less efficient it is. This is different from just producing the highest energy particles. Okay. Is there a way to start with a very low upstream field so you don't have so much heating in the precursor, but end up with a shock field well above 200 microgauss? Well, this is where magnetic field amplification comes in. Before, we had just compression. Now we have to talk about actually amplifying the field, creating magnetic field. And I think this is the answer, but I don't know, because we haven't finished working on this yet. Okay, and this is going to be a modification, a generalization of the Bell and Luchek scheme. So now this is from the poster by Andrei Vladimirov, myself, and Andrei Bikoff, which is hanging up there. What we're trying to do is to generalize the Bell and Luchek approach for magnetic field amplification. We embed a generalized Bell and Luchek model into the Monte Carlo model of the shock structure. And the idea is to derive the particle distribution, the nonlinear shock structure, and the self-generated stochastic magnetic fields all self-consistently without restricting ourselves to delta B over B less than 1. The whole idea behind the Bell and Luchek is that they just said, well, we write equations that are only valid for delta B over B small, but let's just assume they apply everywhere, even when delta B over B is large. And the only reason people accepted that, they didn't accept it 20 years ago, people would have said it then, they accept it now because there's this evidence for these large fields. So we have to do something. So Bell and Luchek made delta B over B much greater than 1 an acceptable, fashionable thing to do. Okay. And now look at these results. So without amplification, we start with 3 microgauss, we end 3 microgauss. This is a parallel shock simulation, no compression. When we put in this, we go from 3 microgauss to 250, and this is all amplification. There's no compression in that result. And these are very preliminary results, but I think they're really quite promising. So the idea is that we may be able to have our cake and eat it too. Maybe we have a very large compression, but still end up with a very high field behind the shock. Now, of course, if you increase the magnetic field, a large field translates to higher energy cosmic rays. So you go from a spectrum like this to a higher, producing higher energy particles. Again, these are very preliminary results. Okay. What else can you do? Well, we still have to worry about constraining what's going on here. Additional constraints on the magnetic field come from observations of the synchrotron emission in the forward shock precursor. Jaco talked about that. One thing to make sure is clear is that this very sharp increase here is not the precursor. This is a projection effect, the line of sight projection effect. If there is a precursor from diffusive shock acceleration particles upstream of the shock, it's here. This is some earlier work, observations from Bamba, 1006, and also Fink and Lamming discussed this, Bereshko et al. And you can, the argument for high fields comes from this rapid fall off here. Jaco talked about this. If this is synchrotron losses, the fields have to be high. What I'm going to talk about is the possibility of a precursor out here. This is not resolved yet, as far as I know, in Chandra observations. Okay. But it's a very important thing, because here's the data basically from Tycho. And the reason you get, remember, this is basically a line of sight effect. This would be the precursor. The reason you have a sharp jump there is not because the magnetic field is so high. The high field tells you something about what's going on here. The reason you have a sharp jump there is because the magnetic field increases from upstream to the shock. It doesn't have to be large. It just has to be a large increase, so there's a large increase in emissivity. So that depends on how the magnetic field is compressed. And we have no idea how the magnetic field is compressed or if it's not compressed at all. So getting a point here in the precursor, and I wouldn't believe these points, I'm just having for illustration, getting an actual real point in the precursor will constrain how the magnetic field is compressed, which is an important part of these models. Okay, I'm not going to say any more about that. Another thing that's very important that I'm just starting to work with Dan Patneau and Pat Slane is to really look at what happens to the thermal X-rays when you have a nonlinear shock model. I did some earlier work with Anne de Crochel and Jean Boulay on this in 2000. The point is that the cosmic ray acceleration modifies the shock density and the temperature. That's going to modify the integral of NEDT in the interaction region. The thermal X-ray emission will depend on how many cosmic rays you produce. That's all there is to it. So we can model that. So the thermal emission is going to depend on how many cosmic rays you produce at the highest energies. But what comes along with that, because our model produces this more or less self-consistent spectrum from thermal to the highest energies, is that we can self-consistently produce the non-thermal synchrotron that matches the thermal emission. So that's the idea here. Hopefully it will work. I was going to say something about relativistic shocks, but I'm not sure I have time. So I think I will stop there. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Ron. Okay, question time.
This RxJ 1713 remnants you've shown. It was an issue, I think, raised by Reimer et al. That if you just apply even linear acceleration theory, you come into conflict with egret observation, up or maybe upper limit. And if you apply nonlinear acceleration theory, which gives you concave spectrum, then you would be in an even bigger trouble, I guess. How can you avoid this conflict with egret observation?
You're talking about the RxJ, yeah. I have to think about that. It's been a while since I actually thought about deep. I didn't have a detailed fit of that here. I just imported the Hess spectrum. I'd have to think about that. I know what you're talking about. It was because of the egret observations in the field of view. But
actually, we consider this can be resolved by assuming that you have a partially ionized medium.
I have to. I'm not going to say anything on that because I haven't thought about it recently.
Yeah, in answer to Misha's comment, yeah, probably, but barely. Just it depends on how, in terms of the nonlinear model. I mean, obviously with an inverse Compton model you can do it. The pi zero is what they raised the issue with, and that's obviously, and it's the same sort of issue that I raised with Yako's talk, is like, well, how much turns over, what will GLAST see relative to the upper bounds that EGRIT provided with the background source. So I think you could probably get it with a nonlinear model, but barely.
I appreciate that you're studying efficient diffusive shock acceleration, which gives this nice concave spectrum, and also there's indications it's seen in the radio emission. Yet I don't understand why we see a very nice power law for the cosmic rays. You make also these statements about how there's a relationship here between the acceleration of the cosmic rays below the knee, yet we see the cosmic ray spectrum below the knee.
It's
a very nice power law with no evidence of...
Yeah, if you look at the actual data of all the different experiments and put them on one plot, and I have a plot I can show you, I don't have it here, it doesn't look so nice.
But okay, if you do that fit and you take the maximum curvature available, does that put a sort of average efficiency for your acceleration, I mean, the diffusive shock acceleration then?
Now, I'm just looking at a single young supernova remnant. And to produce the cosmic ray spectrum, you have to do a model of the galaxy. And you have to add all these together. And I mean, it's very, very complicated. And then you have escape from the galaxy. You have all these other problems. This is exactly why I'm looking at individual remnants, where we have a hope of pinning these things down, to see if the mechanism works there. I'm not sure that I can explain the cosmic ray spectrum. That's going to take these more global models. But I think to even start with the global model, you need to have the proper input. What I'm trying to do is get the input that matches individual supernova remnants, and then we can put that in these global models and see if you can come up with something that works.
You also made a statement that there's a measure of efficiency that's proportional to the Mach number.
I said that the efficiency generally goes up with the sonic Mach number. Yes.
But there's no real functional form for that expression.
No, because it's nonlinear. And of course, you can't have a functional form, well, because you end up with 99% efficiency once you get Mach numbers above 20 or 30 or 50.
And it's also very model dependent, right?
No, it's not model dependent at all, because it's so efficient. You can
at the highest energies, at the highest Mach numbers.
Right, but you don't have to go that high to get very high efficiency. So it's not model dependent at all. It depends on we make assumptions for the injection. And if the injection somehow is much lower than we assume, then it won't be efficient, then it will be model dependent.
Just wondering, in your opinion, is efficient cosmic ray acceleration a general property of young supernova remnant shocks, especially if he's saying... Do you see a lot of synchrotron emission or something?
Well, I think we saw some cases, even in individual remnants, where it may be accelerating cosmic rays efficiently in one region and not in another. So it does depend on the parameters. If you have a neutral medium, you're not going to accelerate cosmic rays. If you have, you can have. There are other things that can damp the acceleration and prevent it from happening. But so I don't think it occurs universally, but.
Any other? What's the efficiency of putting energy into the magnetic field in a supernova explosion? I mean, you said you could get 50% in cosmic rays. What percentage goes and ends up in the magnetic field if you do this enormous?
We don't know yet. We just started doing that work.
If you assume it's 200, whatever it is, 250 micrograus for the new...
Those particular models, we put about 10% of the energies in the magnetic field pressure. Well, there are a lot of other complications. So. I have enough trouble doing this. I can't bring you all these complications at once. Not at once.
Well, what's next after this one? What's next? What are you going to put in after
this? Well, actually, the magnetic field amplification is the big deal. We just started that with Andrei Vladimirov. I think that's really important. I think the Monte Carlo is well suited to that, so that's probably the thing. that's certainly something that we can get out. The heat, we calculate the heating in the precursor, not in that hydro model I showed, because that's a very simple one. But in the Monte Carlo model, that's certainly something that is in the model. We calculate it. I don't have the numbers right here. But also, the precursor slows. So when you talk about the speed of the neutrons coming through, that's going to be a little bit different.
What do your models predict about the density in the ambient medium, and then the temperature in the shocked ambient forward shock? Do you have any predictions for that?
Well, these models all have those numbers in it. Again, these are kind of toy models. Here I use the upstream density of 0.5, and there's a compression ratio of 6, so that gives you the shock density right behind the shock.
Okay, so but what is your temperature? Do you have an estimate of the temperature of the thermal pool?
In that particular model, I don't have it handy, but I can show you this other plot that I had. Where was it? Is it the other way? I don't know. It's somewhere. I don't have it for that particular model.
So I mean, I guess the question is it 1 keV? Is it 100 eV?
Now, first of all, the only temperature that I get out is the proton temperature, not the electron temperature. And if the acceleration is very efficient, it's typically a factor of 10 times less than what the test particle value would be. So the test particle value, depending on the shock speed, can easily be 10 to the 8th or more. And this is a factor of 10 or 20 less than that. I don't have the numbers here, but I could give you the numbers for any particular set of parameters. Exactly. It changes that because the equilibration depends on the density. The density can be, you know, twice as great or four times as great as you expect. Plus, the proton temperature is less, so the equilibration time is much less.
I saw from Jaco Vink's talk that in 2006, supernova 2006 and RCW86, the fields are much weaker, 33 and 20 micrograms. So can you get it going down also again after the amplification?
I can, yes, because I can just start with parameters and run the model. And I had previous models where I fitted 1006, where we didn't have any amplification, and we had relatively. Part of it is this compression. See, the reason the fields are so high here, and this is true of this model and my model, the reason they end up with such high fields is that they assume that the magnetic field is compressed in the shock. Now, this is a bit of a swindle in both their model and mine, this simple one, because these are parallel shocks, basically, and we just put in by hand this compression. If we didn't put in compression, we would start with 10 microgauss, we'd end up with 10 microgauss, and you could match the 1006. That's why I wanted to look at that precursor, because that precursor actually will tell you how much magnetic field, it won't tell it to you, certainly give you a hint of how much compression you have. Fortunately, in a talk like this, I can't list all the approximations and possible errors in the model and stuff like that.
There's quite a lot of assumptions going into the Bell-Lucek model, though, because you've got to take a scale length for the gradient of the cosmic ray pressure. And so what are you doing with that?
Well, that's what we can do better than they can, because we actually calculate the precursor in the Monte Carlo. So we are going to do their model both spatially dependent and momentum dependent, where they did not. They had a single scale and a single momentum. So we're going to generalize it in that regard.
Okay, we've come to a timely part of the proceedings now. Wine and cheese will be starting any second now, so I'd just like to thank all the speakers this afternoon. Thank you.